need to learn, except by showing you your mistakes over and over again until you stop making them." She rapped his helm once more. "Even if it means I have to beat you black and blue in order to do it." That she continued to defeat him with such regularity hurt his pride far more than he was willing to admit, even to Sephira, and it made him doubt whether he would ever be able to triumph over Galbatorix, Murtagh, or any other truly formidable opponent, should he be so unfortunate as to face them in single combat, without the help of Sephira or his magic. Wheeling away from Arya, Aragorn stomped over to a spot some 10 yards distant. "Well," he said through clenched teeth, "get on with it then." And he settled into a low crouch as he readied himself for another onslaught. Arya narrowed her eyes to slits, which gave her angled face an evil look. "Very well." They rushed at each other, both shouting war cries, and the field echoed with the sounds of their furious clash. Match after match they fought, until they were tired, sweaty, and coated with dust, and Aragorn was striped with many painful welts. And still they continued to dash themselves against one another with a grim-faced determination that had hitherto been absent from their duels. Neither of them asked to end their brutal, bruising contest, and neither of them offered to. Sephira watched from the side of the field, where she lay sprawled across the springy mat of grass. For the most part, she kept her thoughts to herself, so as to avoid distracting Aragorn. But every now and then, she made a short observation about his technique, or Arya's. Observations that Aragorn invariably found helpful. Also, he suspected that she had intervened on more than one occasion to save him from a particularly dangerous blow. For at times his arms and legs seemed to move slightly faster than they should have, or even slightly before he intended to move them himself. And when that happened, he felt a tickle in the back of his mind that he knew meant Sephira was meddling with some part of his consciousness. At last, he asked her to stop. "I have to be able to do this myself, Sephira," he said. "You can't help me every time I need it."
"I can try."
"I know. I feel the same way about you. But this is my mountain to climb, not yours." The edge of her lip twitched.
"Why climb when you can fly? You'll never get anywhere on those short little legs of yours."
"That's not true, and you know it. Besides, if I were flying, it would be on borrowed wings, and I would gain nothing by it, other than the cheap thrill of an unearned victory."
"Victory is victory, and dead is dead, however it is achieved."
"Sephira," he said warningly.
"Little one."
Still to his relief, she left him to his own devices after that, though she continued to watch him with unceasing vigilance. Along with Sephira, the elves assigned to guard her and Aragorn had gathered along the edge of the field. Their presence made Aragorn uncomfortable. He disliked having anyone other than Sephira or Arya witness his failures, but he knew the elves would never agree to withdraw to the tents. In any event, they did serve one useful purpose, aside from protecting him and Sephira, keeping the other warriors on the field from wandering over to gawk at a rider and an elf going at it hammer and tongs. Not that Blodgarm spellcasters did anything specific to discourage onlookers, but their very aspect was intimidating enough to ward off casual spectators. The longer he fought with Arya, the more frustrated Aragorn became. He won 2 of their matches, barely, frantically, with desperate ploys that succeeded more by luck than skill, and that he never would have attempted in a real duel unless he no longer cared for his own safety. But except for those isolated victories, Arya continued to beat him with depressing ease. Eventually, Aragorn's anger and frustration boiled over, and all sense of proportion deserted him. Inspired by the methods that had granted him his few successes, Aragorn lifted his right arm and prepared to throw Brisinger at Arya, even as he might a battle axe. Just at that moment, another mind touched Aragorn's. A mind that Aragorn instantly knew belonged neither to Arya nor Sephira, nor any of the other elves, for it was unmistakably male, and it was unmistakably dragon. Aragorn recoiled from the contact, racing to order his thoughts so as to ward off what he feared was an attack by Thorn. But before he could, An immense voice echoed through the shadowy byways of his consciousness, like the sound of a mountain shifting under its own weight.
"Enough," said Cleda.
Aragorn stiffened and stumbled forward a half step, rising onto the balls of his feet as he stopped himself from throwing Brisinga. He saw or sensed Arya, Sephira, and Blodgarm's spellcasters react as well, stirring with surprise, and he knew that they too had heard Cleda. The dragon's mind felt much the same as before, old and unfathomable, and torn with grief. But for the first time since Oromis's death at Gilead, Cleda seemed possessed of an urge to do something other than sink ever deeper into the all-enveloping morass of his private torments.
"Cleda, Elder," Aragorn and Sephira said at the same time.
"How are you?"
"Are you all right?"
"Did you?"
Others spoke as well, Arya, Blodgarm, two more of the elves whom Aragorn could not identify, and their mass of conflicting words clattered together in an incomprehensible discord.
"Enough," Cleda repeated, sounding both weary and exasperated. "Do you wish to attract unwanted attention?"
At once everyone fell silent, as they waited to hear what the golden dragon would say next. Excited, Aragorn exchanged glances with Arya. Cleda did not speak immediately, but watched them for another few minutes, his presence weighing heavily against Aragorn's consciousness, even as Aragorn was sure it did with the others. Then in his sonorous, magisterial voice, Cleda said,
"This has gone on long enough. Aragorn, you should not spend so much time sparring. It is distracting you from more important matters. The sword in Galbatorix's hand is not what you need to fear the most, nor the sword in his mouth, but rather the sword in his mind. His greatest talent lies in his ability to worm his way into the smallest parts of your being and force you to obey his will. Instead of these bouts with Arya, you should concentrate on improving your mastery over your thoughts. They are still woefully undisciplined. Why then do you still persist with this futile endeavor?"
A host of answers leaped to the forefront of Aragorn's mind. That he enjoyed crossing blades with Arya despite the aggravation it caused him. That he wanted to be the very best sword fighter he could, the very best in the world if possible. That the exercise helped calm his nerves and shape his body. And many more reasons besides. He tried to suppress the welter of thoughts, both to preserve some measure of privacy and to avoid inundating Cleda with unwanted information, thus confirming the dragon's opinion about his lack of discipline. He did not entirely succeed, however, and a faint air of disappointment emanated from Cleda. Aragorn chose his strongest arguments. "If I can hold Galbatorix off with my mind, even if I can't beat him, if I can just hold him off, then this may still be decided by the sword. In any case, the king isn't the only enemy we should be worried about. There's Murtagh, for one, and who knows what other kinds of men or creatures Galbatorix has in his service. I wasn't able to defeat Durza by myself, nor Varog, nor even Murtagh. Always I've had help. But I can't rely on Arya or Sephira or Blodgarm to rescue me every time I get into trouble. I have to be better with a blade, and yet I can't seem to make any progress no matter how hard I try."
"Varog?" Cleda queried. "I have not heard that name before."
It fell to Aragorn then to tell Cleda about the capture of Feinster, and how he and Arya had killed the newly born Shade, even as Oromis and Cleda had met their deaths, differing kinds of deaths, but both still mortal ends, while battling in the skies over Gilead. Aragorn also summarized the Varden's activities thereafter, for he realized that Cleda had kept himself so isolated he had little knowledge of them. The account took Aragorn several minutes to deliver, during which time he and the elves stood frozen on the field, staring past each other with unseeing eyes, their attention turned inward as they concentrated on the rapid exchange of thoughts, images, and feelings. Another long silence followed,
as Glader digested what he had learned. When he again deigned to speak, it was with a tinge of amusement.
"You are overly ambitious if your goal is to be able to kill shades with impunity. Even the oldest and wisest of the riders would have hesitated to attack a shade alone. You have already survived encounters with two of them, which is two more than most. Be grateful you have been so lucky, and leave it at that. Trying to outmatch a shade is like trying to fly higher than the sun."
"Yes," replied Aragorn, "but our foes are as strong as shades, or even stronger, and Galbatorix may create more of them just to slow our progress. He uses them carelessly, without heed for the destruction they could cause throughout the land."
"Eberthil," said Arya, "he is right. Our enemies are deadly in the extreme, as you well know."
This she added in a gentle tone.
"And Aragorn is not at the level he needs to be. To prepare for what lies before us, he has to attain mastery. I have done my best to teach him, but mastery ultimately must come from within, not without."
Her defense of him warmed Aragorn's heart. As before, Glada was slow to respond.
"Nor has Aragorn mastered his thoughts, as he must also do. Neither of these abilities, mental or physical, is of much use alone. But of the two, the mental is more important. One can win a battle against both a spellcaster and a swordsman with the mind alone. Your mind and your body ought to be in balance. But if you must choose which of them to train, you should choose your mind. Arya, Blodgam, Yela, you know this is true. Why have none of you taken it upon yourselves to continue Aragorn's instruction in this area?"
Arya cast her eyes at the ground, somewhat like a chastised child, while the fur on Blodgarm's shoulders rippled and stood on end, and he pulled back his lips to reveal the tips of his sharp white fangs. It was Blodgarm who finally dared reply. Speaking wholly in the ancient language, the first to do so, he said,
"Arya is here as the ambassador of our people. I and my band are here to protect the lives of Saphira Brightscales and Aragorn Shadeslayer. And it has been a difficult and time-consuming task. We have all tried to help Aragorn, but it is not our place to train a rider, nor would we assume to attempt it when one of his rightful masters was still alive and present, even if that master was neglecting his duty."
Dark clouds of anger gathered within Glada, like massive thunderheads building on the horizon. Aragorn distanced himself from Glada's consciousness, wary of the dragon's wrath. Glada was no longer capable of physically harming anyone, but he was still incredibly dangerous, and should he lose control and lash out with his mind, none of them would be able to withstand his might. Blodgarm's rudeness and insensitivity initially shocked Aragorn. He had never heard an elf speak to a dragon like that before. But after a moment's reflection, Aragorn realized that Blodgarm must have done it to draw Glader out, and prevent him from retreating into his shell of misery. Aragorn admired the elf's courage, but he wondered whether insulting Glader was really the best approach. It certainly wasn't the safest plan. The billowing thunderheads swelled in size, illuminated by brief lightning-like flashes, as Glader's mind jumped from one thought to another.
"You have overstepped your bounds, elf," he growled, also in the ancient language. "My actions are not for you to question. You cannot even begin to comprehend what I have lost. If it were not for Aragorn and Saphira, and my duty to them, I would have gone mad long ago. So do not accuse me of negligence, Blodgarm, son of Ildred, unless you wish to test yourself against the last of the High Old Ones."
Baring his teeth even more, Blodgarm hissed. In spite of that, Aragorn detected a hint of satisfaction in the elf's visage. To Aragorn's dismay, Blodgarm pressed on, saying,
Then do not blame us for failing to fulfill what are your responsibilities, not ours, old one. Our whole race mourns your loss, but you cannot expect us to make allowances for your self-pity when we are at war with the most deadly enemy in our history. The same enemy who exterminated nearly every one of your kind, and who also killed your rider.
Glader's fury was volcanic. Black and terrible, it battered against Aragorn with such force, he felt as if the fabric of his being might split asunder like a sail caught in the wind. On the other side of the field, he saw men drop their weapons and clutch at their heads, grimacing with pain.
"My self-pity," said Glader,
forcing out each word, and each word sounding like a pronouncement of doom. In the recesses of the dragon's mind, Aragorn sensed something unpleasant taking shape, that if allowed to reach fruition, might be the cause of much sorrow and regret. Then Saphira spoke, and her mental voice cut through Glader's churning emotions, like a knife through water.
"Master," she said, "I have been worried about you. It is good to know that you are well and strong again. None of us are your equal, and we have need of your help. Without you, we cannot hope to defeat the Empire."
Glader rumbled ominously, but he did not ignore, interrupt, or insult her. Indeed, her praise seemed to please him, even if only a little. After all, as Aragorn reflected, if there was one thing dragons were susceptible to, it was flattery, as Saphira was well aware. Without pausing to allow Glader to respond, Saphira said,
"Since you no longer have use of your wings, let me offer my own as a replacement. The air is calm, the sky is clear, and it would be a joy to fly high above the ground, higher than even the eagles dare soar. After so long trapped within your heart of hearts, you must yearn to leave all this behind, and feel the currents of air rising beneath you once more."
The black storm within Glader abated somewhat, although it remained vast and threatening, teetering on the edge of renewed violence.
"That would be pleasant. Then we shall fly together soon. But, Master..."
"Yes, youngling."
"There is something I wish to ask of you first."
"Then ask it."
"Will you help Aragorn with his swordsmanship? Can you help him? He isn't as skilled as he needs to be, and I don't want to lose my rider."
Saphira remained dignified throughout, but there was a note of pleading in her voice that caused Aragorn's throat to tighten. The thunderheads collapsed inward on themselves, leaving behind a bare grey landscape that seemed inexpressibly sad to Aragorn. Glader paused. Strange, half-seen shapes moved slowly along the edge of the landscape, hulking monoliths that Aragorn had no desire to meet up close.
"Very well," Glader said at long last. "I will do what I can for your rider, but after we are done on this field, he must let me teach him as I see fit."
"Agreed," said Saphira.
Aragorn saw Arya and the other elves relax, as if they had been holding their breath. Aragorn withdrew from the others for a moment, as Triana and several other magicians who served in the Varden contacted him, each demanding to know what they had just felt tearing at their minds, and what had so upset the men and animals in the camp. Triana overrode the others, saying,
"Are we under attack, Shadeslayer? Is it Thorn? Is it Shrukan?"
Her panic was so strong, it made Aragorn want to throw down his sword and shield and run for safety.
"No, everything is fine," he said as evenly as he could.
Glader's existence was still a secret to most of the Varden, including Triana and the magicians who answered to her. Aragorn wanted to keep it that way, lest word of the Golden Dragon should reach the Empire's spies. Lying while in communication with another person's mind was difficult in the extreme, since it was nearly impossible to avoid thinking about whatever it was you wanted to keep hidden. so Aragorn kept the conversation as short as he could. "The elves and I were practicing magic. I'll explain it later. But there's no need to be worried." He could tell that his reassurances did not entirely convince them, but they dared not press him for a more detailed explanation, and bade him farewell before walling off their minds from his inner eye. Arya must have noticed a change in his bearing, for she walked over to him, and in a low murmur asked, "Is everything all right?" "Fine," Aragorn replied in a similar undertone. He nodded toward the men who were picking up their weapons. "I had to answer a few questions."
"Ah, you didn't tell them who..."
"Of course not."
"Take up your positions as before,"
Glaedha rumbled, and Aragorn and Arya separated and paced off 20 feet in either direction. Knowing that it might be a mistake, but unable to restrain himself, Aragorn said, "Master, can you really teach me what I need to know before we reach Urabane? So little time is left to us, I
can teach you right now, if you will listen to me," said Glaedha. "But you will have to listen harder than ever before."
"I am listening, Master." Still, Aragorn could not help wondering how much the dragon really knew about sword fighting. Glaedha would have learned a great deal from Oromis, even as Saphira had learned from Aragorn. But despite those shared experiences, Glaedha had never held a sword himself. How could he have? Glaedha instructing Aragorn on fencing would be like Aragorn instructing a dragon on how to navigate the thermals rising off the side of a mountain. Aragorn could do it, but he would not be able to explain it as well as Saphira, for his knowledge was second-hand, and no amount of abstract contemplation could overcome that disadvantage. Aragorn kept his doubts to himself, but something of them must have seeped past his barriers to Glaedha, because the dragon made an amused sound, or rather he imitated one within his mind, the habits of the body being hard to forget, and said,
"All great fighting is the same, Aragorn, even as all great warriors are the same. Past a certain point, it does not matter whether you wield a sword, a claw, a tooth, or a tail. It is true you must be capable with your weapon, but anyone with the time and the inclination can acquire technical proficiency. To achieve greatness, though, that requires artistry. That requires imagination and thoughtfulness. And it is those qualities that the best warriors share, even if on the surface they appear completely different."
Glaedha fell silent for a moment, then said,
"Now, what was it I told you before?"
Aragorn did not have to even stop to consider that I had to learn to see what I was looking at. "And I've tried, Master. I have."
"But still, you do not see. Look at Arya. Why has she been able to beat you again and again? Because she understands you, Aragorn. She knows who you are and how you think. And that is what allows her to defeat you so consistently. Why is it Murtagh was able to trounce you on the Burning Plains, even though he was nowhere near as fast or as strong as you?"
"Because I was tired and..."
"And how is it he succeeded in wounding you in the hip when last you met? And yet you were only able to give him a scratch on the cheek. I will tell you, Aragorn. It was not because you were tired and he was not. No, it was because he understands you, Aragorn, but you do not understand him. Murtagh knows more than you, and thus he has power over you, as does Arya."
And still Glaedha spoke.
"Look at her, Aragorn. Look at her well. She sees you for who you are. But do you see her in return? Do you see her clearly enough to defeat her in battle?"
Aragorn locked eyes with Arya, and found within them a combination of determination and defensiveness, as if she was challenging him to attempt to pry open her secrets. But she was also afraid of what would happen if he did. Doubt welled up inside Aragorn. Did he really know her as well as he thought? Or had he deceived himself into mistaking the outer for the inner?
"You have allowed yourself to become angrier than you should," said Glader softly. "Anger has its place, but it will not help you here. The way of the warrior is the way of knowing. If that knowledge requires you to use anger, then you use anger. But you cannot wrest forth knowledge by losing your temper. Pain and frustration will be your only reward if you try. Instead, you must strive to be calm, even if 100 ravening enemies are snapping at your heels. Empty your mind and allow it to become like a tranquil pool that reflects everything around it and yet remains untouched by its surroundings. Understanding will come to you in that emptiness, when you are free of irrational fears about victory and defeat, life and death. You cannot predict every eventuality, and you cannot guarantee success every time you face an enemy. But by seeing all and discounting nothing, you may adapt without hesitation to any change. The warrior who can adapt the easiest to the unexpected is the warrior who will live the longest. So look at Arya, see what you are looking at, and then take the action you deem most appropriate. And once you are in motion, do not allow your thoughts to distract you. Think without thinking, so that you act as if out of instinct and not reason. Go now, and try."
Aragorn took a minute to collect himself and consider everything he knew about Arya. Her likes and dislikes, her habits and mannerisms, the important events of her life, what she feared and what she hoped for, and most importantly, her underlying temperament, that which dictated her approach to life and to fighting. All that he considered, and from it he attempted to divine the essence of her personality. It was a daunting task, especially since he made an effort to view her not as he usually did, as a beautiful woman he admired and longed for, but as the person she actually was, whole and complete, and separate from his own needs and wants. He drew what conclusions he could within such a brief span of time, although he worried that his observations were childish and overly simplistic. Then he set aside his uncertainty, stepped forward, and raised his sword and shield. He knew that Arya would be expecting him to try something different, so he opened their duel as he had twice before, shuffling in a diagonal toward her right shoulder, as if to circumvent her shield and attack her flank where it was unguarded. The ruse would not fool her, but it would keep her guessing as to what he was actually up to, and the longer he could maintain that uncertainty, the better. A small rough rock turned under the ball of his right foot. He shifted his weight to the side so as to keep his balance. The motion caused a nearly indiscernible hitch in his otherwise smooth stride, but Arya spotted the irregularity and leaped at him, a clarion yell ringing from her lips. Their swords glanced off one another once, twice, and then Aragorn turned, and possessed of a sudden and deep-seated conviction that Arya was going to strike next at his head. He stabbed at her chest fast as he could, aiming for a spot near her breastbone that she would have to leave open if she swung at his helm. His intuition was right, but his reckoning was off. He stabbed so quickly, Arya did not have an opportunity to move her arm out of the way, and the hilt of her sword deflected Brisinga's dark blue tip and sent it sailing harmlessly past her cheek. An instant later, the world tilted around Aragorn, and bursts of red and orange sparks appeared, scattered across his field of vision. He staggered and dropped to one knee, supporting himself with both hands on the ground. A dull roaring filled his ears. The sound gradually subsided, at which point Glader said,
"Do not try to move quickly, Aragorn. Do not try to move slowly. Only move at the correct moment, and your blow will appear neither fast nor slow, but effortless. Timing is everything in battle. You must pay close attention to the patterns and rhythms of your opponents' bodies, where they are strong, where they are weak, where stiff and where flexible. Match those rhythms when it serves your purpose, and confuse them when it does not. And you will be able to shape the flow of the battle as it pleases you. This you should understand thoroughly. Fix it in your mind, and think on it more later. Now, try again.
Glaring at Arya, Aragorn got back to his feet, shook his head to clear it, and for what seemed like the 100th time, assumed an on-guard position. His welts and bruises flared with renewed pain, making him feel like an arthritic old man. Arya tossed back her hair and smiled at him, baring her strong white teeth. The gesture had no effect on him. He was focused on the task at hand and was not about to allow himself to fall for the same trick twice. Even before the smile began to fade from her lips, he was sprinting forward, Brisinger held low and to the side while he led with his shield. As he hoped, the position of his sword tempted Arya into a rash, preemptive strike, a slashing blow that would have taken him in the collarbone if it had landed. Aragorn ducked underneath the blow, letting it bounce off his shield, and brought Brisinger up and around as if to cut her across the legs and hips. She blocked him with her shield, then shoved him away, knocking the air from his lungs. A brief lull followed, as they circled each other, both searching for an opening to exploit. The air between them was fraught with tension as he studied her, and she him, their movements quick and jerky, almost bird-like, from the overabundance of energy coursing through their veins. The strain broke, like a glass rod snapping in two. He struck at her, and she parried, their blades moving with such speed they were nearly invisible. As they exchanged blows, Aragorn kept his eyes riveted on hers, but he also strove, as Glaeda had advised, to observe the rhythms and patterns of her body, while also remembering who she was and how she was likely to act and react. He wanted to win so badly, he felt as if he might burst if he didn't. And yet, despite all his efforts, Arya caught him by surprise with a reverse pommel strike to his ribs. Aragorn stopped and swore an oath.
"That was better," said Glaeda. "Much better. Your timing was almost perfect."
"But not quite."
"No, not quite. You are still too angry, and your mind is still too cluttered. Keep hold of the things you need to remember, but don't let them distract you from what is happening. Find a place of calm within yourself, and let the concerns of the world wash over you without sweeping you away with them. You should feel as you did when Oromis had you listen to the thoughts of the creatures in the forest. Then you were aware of everything that was going on around you, yet you were not fixated on any one detail. Do not look at Arya's eyes alone. Your focus is too narrow, too detailed."
"But Brom told me..."
"There are many ways of using the eyes. Brom had his, but it was not the most flexible of styles, nor the most appropriate for large battles. He spent most of his life fighting one-on-one or in small groups, and his habits reflected that. Better to see widely than to see too closely, and allow some feature of a place or situation to catch you unawares. Do you understand?"
"Yes, master."
"Then once more, and this time allow yourself to relax and broaden your perception."
Aragorn again reviewed his knowledge of Arya. When he had decided on a plan, he closed his eyes, slowed his breathing, and sank deep within himself. His fears and anxieties gradually drained out of him, leaving behind a profound emptiness that dulled the pain of his injuries and gave him a sense of unusual clarity. Though he did not lose interest in winning, the prospect of defeat no longer troubled him. What would be, and he would not struggle unnecessarily against the decrees of fate. "Ready?" asked Arya, when he opened his eyes again. "Ready." They took up their starting positions, then stayed there, motionless, each of them waiting for the other to attack first. The sun was to Aragorn's right, which meant that if he could maneuver Arya in the opposite direction, the light would be in her eyes. He had tried before without success, but now he thought of a way he might be able to manage it. He knew that Arya was confident she could beat him. He was sure she did not disregard his abilities. But however conscious she was of his skill and his desire to improve, she had won the overwhelming majority of their matches. Those experiences had shown her that he would be easy to defeat, even if intellectually she might know better. Her confidence, therefore, was also her weakness.
"She thinks she's better than me with a sword," he said to himself, "and maybe she is. But I can use her expectations against her. They'll be her undoing, if anything is."
He sidled forward a few feet and smiled at Arya, even as she had smiled at him. Her face stayed impressively blank. A moment later, she charged him, as if she was going to tackle him and drive him to the ground. He sprang backward, edging to the right, so as to begin guiding her in the direction he wanted. Arya stopped short, several yards away from him, and remained as still as a wild animal caught in a clearing. Then she traced a half-circle in front of her with her sword, while she stared at him. He suspected that having Glaedah watching them made her all the more determined to give a good showing of herself. She shocked him then by uttering a soft, cat-like growl. Like her smile before, the growl was a weapon for unsettling him, and it worked, but only partly, for he had come to expect such gestures, if not that particular one. Arya crossed the intervening distance with a single bound and began swinging at him with heavy, looping blows that he blocked with his shield. He let her attack without opposition, as if her blows were too strong for him to do anything more than defend himself. With every loud, painful jolt to his arm and shoulder, he retreated farther to the right, stumbling now and then to increase the impression of being driven back. And still he remained calm and composed. Empty. He knew that the opportune moment was going to arrive, even before it did. And once it had, he acted without thought or hesitation, without attempting to be fast or slow, seeking only to fulfill the potential of that single, perfect instant. As Arya's sword descended toward him in a flashing arc, he pivoted to the right, sidestepping the blade, while also putting the sun squarely at his back. The tip of her sword buried itself in the ground with a solid thunk. Arya turned her head so as to keep him in sight, and made the mistake of looking directly into the sun. She squinted, and her pupils contracted to small, dark spots. While she was blinded, Aragorn stabbed Brisinger underneath her left arm, poking her in the ribs. He could have struck her on the nape of her neck, and he would have, if they had really been fighting. But he refrained, for even with a dulled sword, such a blow could kill. Arya let out a sharp cry as Brisinger made contact, and she fell back several steps. She stood with her arm pressed against her side, and her brow furrowed with pain, and stared at him with an odd expression.
"Excellent!" Glaedah crowed. "And again!"
Aragorn felt a momentary glow of satisfaction. Then he released his hold on the emotion, and returned to his previous state of detached watchfulness. When Arya's face cleared and she lowered her arm, she and Aragorn carefully edged around each other until neither had the sun in their eyes, at which point they began anew. Aragorn quickly noticed that Arya was treating him with greater caution than before. Most times that would have pleased him and inspired him to attack more aggressively, but he resisted the urge, for it now seemed obvious to him that she was doing it on purpose. If he swallowed her bait, he would soon find himself at her mercy, as he had so often before. The duel lasted for only a few seconds, though it was still long enough for them to exchange a flurry of blows. Shields cracked, chunks of torn sod flew over the ground, and sword rang against sword as they flowed from one stance to another, their bodies twisting through the air like twin columns of smoke. In the end, the result was the same as before. Aragorn slipped past Arya's guard with an adroit bit of footwork and a flick of his wrist, which resulted in him slashing Arya across her chest from shoulder to sternum. The blow staggered Arya, and she collapsed to one knee, where she remained scowling and breathing heavily through pinched nostrils. Her cheeks grew unusually pale, save for a crimson blotch that appeared high on each side.
"Again!"
ordered Glada. Aragorn and Arya complied without question. With his two victories, Aragorn's weariness had diminished, though he could tell that the opposite was true for Arya. The next match had no clear winner. Arya rallied, and managed to foil all of Aragorn's tricks and traps, even as he did hers. On and on they fought, until at last they were both so tired neither was able to continue, and they stood leaning on swords that were too heavy to lift, panting, sweat dripping from their faces.
"Again,"
said Glada in a low voice. Aragorn grimaced as he yanked Brisinger out of the ground. The more exhausted he became, the harder it was to keep his mind uncluttered and to ignore the complaints of his aching body. Also, he found it increasingly difficult to maintain an even temper and avoid falling prey to the foul mood that usually beset him when he needed rest. Learning to deal with that challenge, he supposed, was part of what Glada was trying to teach him. His shoulders were burning too much for him to hold his sword and shield in front of him. Instead, Aragorn let them hang by his waist, and hoped he could lift them fast enough when needed. Arya did the same. They shuffled toward each other, in a crude imitation of their earlier grace. Aragorn was utterly spent, and yet he refused to give up. In a way that he did not entirely understand, their sparring seemed to have become something more than just a test of arms. It had become a test of who he was, of his character, of his strength, and of his resilience. Nor was it Glada who was testing him, or so he felt, but rather Arya. It was as if she wanted something from him, as if she wanted him to prove what, he knew not. But he was determined to acquit himself as well as he could. However long she was willing to keep sparring, so too was he, no matter how much it hurt. A drop of sweat rolled into his left eye. He blinked, and Arya lunged at him, shouting. Once more, they engaged in their deadly dance, and once more, they fought to a standstill. Fatigue made them clumsy, yet they moved together with a rough harmony that prevented either from gaining victory. Eventually, they ended up standing face to face, their swords locked at their hilts, pushing at each other with what little remained of their strength. Then, as they stood there, struggling back and forth without avail, Aragorn said in a low, fierce voice,
"I see you."
A bright spark appeared in Arya's eyes, then vanished just as quickly. A heart to heart. Glada had them fight twice more. Each duel was shorter than the last, and each resulted in a draw, which frustrated the Golden Dragon more than it did Aragorn or Arya. Glada would have kept them sparring until it became abundantly clear who was the better warrior. But by the end of the last duel they were both so tired that they dropped to the ground and lay side by side, heaving for air. And even Glada had to admit that it would be counterproductive, if not downright harmful, for them to continue. Once they had recovered enough to stand and walk, Glada summoned them to Aragorn's tent. First, with energy from Saphira, they healed their more painful injuries. Then they returned their ruined shields to the Varden's weapon master, Frederick, who provided them with replacements, although only after lecturing them on how they ought to take better care of their equipment. When they arrived at the tent, they found Nasawada waiting for them, along with her usual accompaniment of guards. "It's about time," she said in a tart voice. "If the two of you are done trying to batter each other to pieces, we need to talk." Without another word, she ducked inside. Blodgarm and his fellow spellcasters arranged themselves in a large circle around the tent, which Aragorn could tell made Nasawada's guards uneasy. Aragorn and Arya followed Nasawada into the tent. Then Saphira surprised them by pushing the front of her head past the entrance flaps and promptly filling the cramped space with the smell of smoke and burnt meat. The sudden appearance of Saphira's scaly snout took Nasawada aback, but she quickly recovered. Addressing herself to Aragorn, she said, "That was Glada, I felt, wasn't it?" He glanced toward the front of the tent, hoping that her guards were too far away to hear, then nodded. It was.
"Ah, I knew it,"
she exclaimed, sounding satisfied. Then her expression became uncertain.
"May I speak with him? Is it allowed? Or will he only communicate with an elf or a rider?"
Aragorn hesitated and looked to Arya for guidance.
"I don't know," he said. "He still hasn't entirely recovered. He may not want to..."
"I will speak with you, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad,"
Leda said, his voice echoing in their heads.
"Ask of me what you will. Then leave us to our work. There is much that still needs to be done in order to prepare Aragorn for the challenges ahead."
Aragorn had never seen Nasawada look awestruck before, but now she did.
"Where?"
she mouthed, and spread her hands. He pointed at a patch of dirt by his bed. Nasawada raised her eyebrows, then she nodded, and drawing herself up, she formally greeted Gleda. An exchange of pleasantries followed, during the course of which Nasawada inquired after Gleda's health and asked if there was anything the Varden could provide him with. In response to the first question, which had made Aragorn nervous, Gleda politely explained that his health was just fine, thank you, and as far as the second matter went, he needed nothing from the Varden, though he appreciated her concern.
"I no longer eat," he said. "I no longer drink, and I no longer sleep as you would understand it. My only pleasure now, my only indulgence, lies in contemplating how I might bring about Galbatorix's downfall."
"That," said Nasawada, "I can understand, for I feel much the same."
Then she asked Gleda if he had any advice as to how the Varden could capture Drasleona without it costing them an unacceptable amount of men and materiel, as well as, in her words, "handing over Aragorn and Saphira to the Empire like so many trussed-up chickens." She spent some time explaining the situation to Gleda in greater specificity, whereupon, after due consideration, he said,
"I have no easy solution for you, Nasawada. I will continue to think on it. But at the moment, I cannot see a way clear for the Varden. If Murtagh and Thorn were by themselves, I might easily overcome their minds. However, Galbatorix has given them too many Eldonari for me to do that. Even with Aragorn, Saphira, and the elves to help, victory would be no sure thing."
Visibly disappointed, Nasawada was silent for a brief while. Then she pressed her hands flat against the front of her dress and thanked Gleda for his time. She bade them farewell and took her leave, stepping carefully around Saphira's head so as not to touch her. Aragorn relaxed somewhat as he sat on his cot, while Arya seated herself on a short, three-legged stool. He wiped his palms on the knees of his trousers, for his hands felt sticky, as did the rest of him, then offered Arya a drink from his water-skin, which she gratefully accepted. When she was finished, he gulped down several mouthfuls himself. Their sparring had left him ravenous. The water stifled the growls and rumbles coming from his stomach, but he hoped that Gleda would not detain them for much longer. The sun had nearly set, and he wanted to get a hot meal from the Varden's cooks before they damped their fires and turned in for the night. Otherwise he knew he would end up gnawing on stale bread, dried strips of meat, mouldy sheep cheese, and if he was lucky, a raw onion or two. Hardly an appealing prospect. Once they were both settled, Gleda began to speak, lecturing Aragorn on the principles of mental combat. These Aragorn was already familiar with, but he listened closely, and when the golden dragon told him to do something, he followed Gleda's instructions without question or complaint. They soon progressed beyond maxims to applied practice. Gleda started by testing Aragorn's defenses with attacks of ever-increasing strength, which then led them to engaging in all-out battles where they each struggled to obtain dominance, even if only for a moment, over the other's thoughts. While they fought, Aragorn lay on his back with his eyes closed, all of his energies concentrated inward on the tempest that raged between him and Gleda. His earlier exertions had left him weak and thick-headed, whereas the golden dragon was fresh and well-rested, in addition to being immensely powerful. And that made it difficult for Aragorn to do much more than foil Glaeder's attacks. Nevertheless, he managed to hold his own reasonably well, knowing that in a real fight, the winner would have undoubtedly been Glaeder. Fortunately, Glaeder made some allowances for Aragorn's condition. Although, as he said,
"You must be ready to defend your innermost self at any given moment, even when you are sleeping. It may very well be that you will end up facing Galbatorix or Murtagh when you are as exhausted as you are now."
After two more bouts, Glaeder withdrew to the role of a very vocal spectator, while he had Arya take his place as Aragorn's antagonist. She was just as tired as Aragorn, but he quickly found that when it came to a wizard's duel, she was more than his equal. It did not surprise him. The one time before they had clashed in their minds, she had almost killed him, and that was when she was still drugged from her captivity in Gilead. Glaeder's thoughts were disciplined and focused, but even he could not match the iron-bound control Arya exerted over her consciousness. Her self-mastery was a trait Aragorn had noticed was common among the elves. Foremost in that regard had been Oromis, who it seemed to Aragorn had been in such perfect command of himself, never the slightest doubt or worry had bothered him. Aragorn considered the elves' restraint an innate characteristic of their race, as well as a natural outcome of their rigorous upbringing, education, and use of the ancient language. Speaking and thinking in a language that prevented one from lying, and every word of which contained the potential to unlock a spell, discouraged carelessness in thought or speech, and fostered an aversion to allowing one's emotions to sweep one away. As a rule, then, elves possessed far more self-control than the members of other races. He and Arya wrestled with their minds for a few minutes, he seeking to escape her all-encompassing grip, she seeking to pin and hold him so that she could impose her will on his thoughts. She caught him several times, but he always wiggled free after a second or two, though he knew had she meant him harm, it would have been too late to save himself. And the whole time their minds were touching, Aragorn was aware of the wild strains of music that wafted through the dark spaces of Arya's consciousness. They lured him away from his own body, and threatened to snare him in a web of strange and eerie melodies that had no counterparts among earthly songs. He would have happily succumbed to the bewitchment of the music, had it not been for the distraction of Arya's attacks and the knowledge that humans did not often fare well if they became too fascinated with the workings of an elf's mind. He might escape unscathed. He was a rider, after all. He was different. But it was a risk he was not willing to take, not so long as he valued his sanity. He had heard that delving into Blodgarm's mind had reduced Nasawada's guard Garvan to a slack-jawed dreamer. So he resisted the temptation, hard as it was. Then Glaeder had Saphira join the fray, sometimes in opposition to Aragorn, and sometimes in support of him, for as the Elder Dragon said,
"You must be as skilled in this as Aragorn, Brightscales."
The addition of Saphira substantially altered the outcome of their mental struggles. Together, she and Aragorn were able to fend off Arya with regularity, if not ease. Their combined might even allowed them to subdue Arya on two separate occasions. When Saphira was allied with Arya, however, the two of them so outstripped Aragorn that he gave up any attempt at offense, and instead retreated deep inside himself, curling into a tight ball like a wounded animal, while he recited scraps of verse and waited for the waves of mental energy they hurled at him to subside. Lastly, Glaeder had them pair off, he with Arya and Aragorn with Saphira, and they fought a duel like that, as if they were two sets of riders and dragons met in combat. For the first few strenuous minutes, they were fairly matched, but in the end, Glaeder's strength, experience, and cunning, combined with Arya's rigorous proficiency, proved too much for Aragorn and Saphira to overcome, and they had no choice but to concede defeat. Afterward, Aragorn sensed discontent emanating from Glaeder. Stung by it, he said, "We'll do better tomorrow, Master." Glaeder's mood darkened further. Even he seemed weary from their practice.
"You did well enough, youngling. I could not have asked any more from either of you had you been placed under my wing as apprentices in Vroengard. However, it is impossible for you to learn what you need to learn in a matter of days or weeks. Time gushes between our teeth like water, and soon it will all be gone. It takes years to master the art of fighting with your mind. Years and decades and centuries. And even then, there is still more to learn, more to discover. About yourself, about your enemies, and about the very underpinnings of the world.
With an angry growl, he fell silent.
Then we will learn what we can, and let fate decide the rest, said Aragorn. Besides, Galbatorix may have had 100 years to train his mind, but it has also been over 100 years since you last taught him. He's sure to have forgotten something in the interim. With you helping us, I know we can beat him.
Leda snorted.
Your tongue grows ever smoother, Aragorn Shadeslayer.
Nevertheless, he sounded pleased. He admonished them to eat and rest, and then withdrew from their minds and said no more. Aragorn was sure that the golden dragon was still watching them, but Aragorn could no longer feel his presence, and an unexpected sense of emptiness settled over him. A chill crept through his limbs, and he shivered. He, Saphira, and Arya sat in the darkening tent, none of them willing to speak. Then, rousing himself, Aragorn said,
"He seems better."
His voice creaked from disuse, and he again reached for the water skin.
"This is good for him," said Arya. "You are good for him. Without something to give him purpose, his grief would have killed him. That he has survived at all is impressive. I admire him for it. Few beings, human, elf, or dragon, could continue to function rationally after such a loss."
"Brom did."
"He was equally remarkable."
"If we kill Galbatorix and Shrukan, how do you think Clayda will react?"
Saphira asked.
"Will he keep going, or will he just stop?"
Arya's pupils reflected a shimmer of light as she looked past Aragorn towards Saphira.
"Only time will tell. I hope not. But if we are triumphant in Urubane, it may very well be that Glada will find he is no longer able to continue on his own without Oromis. We can't just let him give up."
"I agree."
"It is not our place to stop him if he decides to enter the void," Arya said sternly. "The choice is his to make, and his alone."
"Yes, but we can reason with him and try to help him see that life is still worth living."
She was still for a while, her face solemn. Then she said,
"I do not want him to die. No elf does. However, if every waking moment is a torment to him, then won't it be better for him to seek release?"
Neither Aragorn nor Saphira had an answer for her. The three of them continued to discuss the day's events for a short while longer. Then Saphira pulled her head out of the tent and went to sit on the neighboring patch of grass.
"I feel like a fox with her head stuck down a rabbit hole,"
she complained.
"It makes my scales itch, not being able to see if someone is creeping up on me."
Aragorn expected Arya to leave as well, but to his surprise she stayed, seemingly content to sit and talk with him about this and that. He was only too eager to comply. His earlier hunger had vanished during his bouts of mental combat with her, Saphira, and Glada, and in any case he was more than willing to forego a hot meal in exchange for the pleasure of her company. Night closed in around them, and the camp grew ever quieter as their conversation meandered from one topic to another. Aragorn felt giddy from exhaustion and excitement, almost as if he had drunk too much mead. And he noticed that Arya also seemed more at ease than normal. They talked of many things, of Glada and of their sparring, of the siege of Dras Leona and what might be done about it, and of other less important matters, such as the crane Arya had seen hunting among the rushes by the edge of the lake, and the scale Saphira had lost from her nose, and how the season was turning, and the days were again growing colder. But always they returned to the one topic that was ever present in their thoughts, and that was Galbatorix and what awaited them in Urabane. While they speculated, as they had so many times before, about the types of magical traps Galbatorix might have set for them, and how best to avoid them, Aragorn thought of Saphira's question about Gleda, and he said, "Arya?"
"Yes?"
She drew the word out, her voice rising and falling with a faint lilt.
"What do you want to do, once this is all over?
If we're still alive, that is.
What do you want to do?"
He fingered Brisinga's pommel as he considered the question.
"I don't know. I haven't let myself think much past Urabane. It would depend on what she wants, but I suppose Saphira and I might return to Palancar Valley. I could build a hall on one of the foothills of the mountains. We might not spend much time there, but at least we would have a home to return to when we weren't flying from one part of Alagazia to another."
He half smiled. "I'm sure there will be plenty to keep us busy, even if Galbatorix is dead. But you still haven't answered my question. What will you do if we win? You must have some idea. You've had longer to think about it than I have." Arya drew one leg up onto the stool, wrapped her arms around it, and rested her chin on her knee. In the dim half-light of the tent, her face appeared to float against a featureless black background, like an apparition conjured out of the night.
"I have spent more time among humans and dwarves than I have among the Elfakin," she said, using the elves' name in the ancient language. "I have grown used to it, and I would not want to return to live in Ellesmere. Too little happens there. Centuries can slip by without notice, while you sit and stare at the stars. No, I think I will continue to serve my mother as her ambassador. The reason I first left Duweldenvarden was because I wanted to help right the balance of the world. As you said, there will still be much that needs doing if we manage to topple Galbatorix. Much that needs putting right. And I would be a part of it."
"Ah." It was not exactly what he had hoped she might say, but at least it presented the possibility that they would not entirely lose contact after Urabane, and that he would still be able to see her now and then. If Arya noticed his discontent, she gave no sign of it. They talked for another few minutes. Then Arya made her excuses and rose to leave. As she stepped past him, Aragorn reached toward her as if to stop her, then quickly drew back his hand.
"Wait," he said softly, unsure of what he hoped for, but hoping nevertheless. The beat of his heart increased, pounding in his ears, and his cheeks grew warm.
Arya paused with her back to him by the entrance of the tent.
"Good night, Aragorn," she said.
Then she slipped out between the entrance flaps and vanished into the night, leaving him to sit alone in the dark.
Discovery. The next 3 days passed quickly for Aragorn, if not for the rest of the Varden, who remained mired in lethargy. The standoff with Dras Leona continued unabated, although there was some excitement when Thorn altered his customary location from above the front gates to a section of the rampart several hundred feet to the right. After much discussion, and after consulting extensively with Saphira, Nasawada and her advisers concluded that Thorn had relocated for no other reason than comfort. The other section of rampart was somewhat flatter and longer. Aside from that, the siege lumbered on without change. Meanwhile, Aragorn spent the mornings and evenings studying with Gleda, and the afternoons sparring with Arya and several other elves. His matches with the elves were not as long or strenuous as his previous one with Arya, for it would have been foolish to push himself that hard every day. But his sessions with Gleda were as intense as ever. The ancient dragon never flagged in his efforts to improve Aragorn's skills and knowledge, and he made no allowances for mistakes or exhaustion. Aragorn was pleased to find that he was finally able to hold his own when dueling with the elves. But it was mentally taxing, for if his concentration lapsed for even a moment, he would end up with a sword jabbed in his ribs or pressed against his throat. With his lessons from Gleda, he made what would have been considered exemplary progress under normal circumstances, but given the situation,
Both he and Glada were frustrated with the pace of his learning. On the second day, during his morning lesson with Glada, Aragorn thought